Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Victor Neberhoy on the show. He is currently the CMO of Freetrade, one of the fastest growing fintech apps, which lets users trade stocks and shares for free. They just closed their latest fundraising round by raising £7 million in less than a week. We recorded this episode a week before the crowdfunding launched, so it was interesting to hear of his plans for the raise and speculation, and to now see how successful it's been. They have, to be fair, run several successful crowdfunding rounds before this, and Victor is generally a wealth of insights on the whole topic, and I do ask a lot of questions. As Freetrade is an investing app, Victor also has a lot of knowledge about the market at the moment and how traders are reacting and the state of the economy. Previously, Victor has worked in other startups and for Google and is generally a very knowledgeable human, and it was my pleasure to chat to him about the economy, fundraising, marketing, and all things life and mindsets. I'm sure you will enjoy the conversation. Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. So just to give a quick recap of like your life, just nice to kind of frame who you
are. Sure, yeah. Thanks for having me again on the podcast, Sam. I appreciate it. It's been quite a journey since we talked last time. Mm-hmm. So regarding life, just in a nutshell, so I was born in Hungary. Back then, it was part of the East Bloc. So it was maybe a little bit of a different experience than moving here. I was kind of dealing with looking at maybe different types of problems. When I was young, 90s, gigantic societal upheaval because of the political system change. One of the good opportunities I had, though, is language education was free. So, and it was actually really high quality. I actually learned really, really fluent German and then later English as well in school. And with the advent of the internet, I was like, you know, this is fantastic. I started making friends with people in different countries and all that sort of stuff. And that was a fantastic experience, and which kind of like trained me up language skills wise and opened up the wide world. And I went to university. I was kind of like targeting the cheapest degree I could do because of obvious reasons. And I ended up with a Germanistik degree. So that's German language and literature. That was, I could get it done in 3 years. It kind of based on my German language skills. And then all of my peers, you know, regardless of degree, whatever you did, everybody wanted to work at banks. I never really understood that. I always wanted to work in tech. And this fantastic newish company, Google, was actually hiring in Ireland. And Hungary just joined the EU. So there were three countries where I could work: Ireland, the UK, and Sweden. I actually liked Ireland the most. I was kind of in love with Google. So I applied. I had like 10 interviews, and eventually I got a call that I'm hired. So I packed all my belongings into a purple duffel bag, managed to fill up maybe half of it. Then I took a plane and I landed in Dublin and I started working there. And basically my mindset was that I want to know everything that I do there as part of the search quality team where I worked. So I built my career there, which went from strength to strength. I had the privilege of working in Mountain View, California, as well as in Hyderabad, India, various places with Google. And then after 7 years, I felt like this is my first real job. What else is out there? So I found an amazing opportunity in Hong Kong. So I moved there, leading a digital marketing agency. That was a lot of fun. And then after about a year, for personal reasons, I moved back to Europe to be with my now fiance. We did an MBA together. Then we moved here to London eventually because she rejoined Google again here. And yeah, I think the rest is pretty public domain. I spotted a Crowdcube advertisement on the tube. I thought to myself, this is fantastic. I lived in a couple of countries, but I've never seen something like that. You can be an angel investor. You don't have to have hundreds of thousands of pounds. You don't have to have your solicitor, you know, your own deal flow and all that stuff. You just go to the platform and find companies. So I did that, and I invested in the very first crowdfunding round of Monzo and Revolut as well. And then my third investment was Freetrade. And as soon as I spotted Freetrade, I was like, this company has to exist. This product absolutely has to exist. I've been looking for an investment account. I thought in the UK it would be a sophisticated market, but everything I found was pretty clunky. So I invested as much as I could, which was £3,000. I was the first person who invested that much in the campaign and wasn't a friend or family. So we started talking with Adam, the CEO, and eventually I joined him as his CMO and co-founder.
That's really fascinating. It's nice to hear a bit more of the details because it makes a lot more sense when you hear everything, I think. Because yeah, people can breeze over things quite quickly and miss a lot of stuff. So in terms of your degrees then, so you said you kind of went for like just an easy, well, like a cheaper one as such. So do you feel like you kind of wasted that time by not going for one that would teach you the most, or was it actually just fortunately a super useful degree, or does it just
experience? I think for me, in my specific situation, it was a lot more important that just to get a degree and get on with life and start getting life experience. What I did on the side was more interesting for Google because the internet was still relatively new in 2004, 2005. So I actually started running my own blog. I started coding HTML and CSS, and that's kind of what that extracurricular bit is what caught the recruiter's eyes at Google. That kind of, you know, what moved the needle. They were also looking for German language skills, so it was kind of like perfect mix. But later, when I went, you know, came back to Europe from Hong Kong, I did an MBA. So it's kind of like nice to, for me, it worked out. And I think actually studying something like linguistics is actually not necessarily a bad decision in my context. I greatly enjoy that, but yeah, each to its own.
Yeah, like results come from like side hustles and things, and like you kind of work on the one focus, but actually like the other thing that...
Yeah, exactly. Honestly, I think side hustles are really important when you are young. Now, definitely no side hustles for me.
Yeah.
My focus is Freetrade, and then my side hustle is Freetrade. Exploring what kind of paths you are going to take. I think trying out these things and, you know, doing projects.
Just to like sort of skip through a bit to then your MBA, what was the specific thing you wanted to learn from your MBA, and what was like the skills you really gained? And
yeah, so I burned my way up to mid-management at Google at the time, and that sounds great. But for me personally, I wanted to put my business knowledge into a structure, and I wanted to understand more. I never studied something like corporate finance or accounting, so I had the opportunity to do that as part of my MBA curriculum. And it was eye-opening. I actually learned a lot, and that's exactly what I wanted from the MBA, to kind of like structure my business knowledge and help me sort of understand companies and how it all works. And that was kind of like a good jumping off point into entrepreneurship, kind of like set me up with more confidence and skills.
It's interesting. See, I've never studied business as such. So it's always a bit intriguing for me to wonder like what people learn in things. And do you think that maybe it would be useful if I'm going to start like trying to do bigger things? It's fine for like just hustling by yourself, but yeah, not launching my own bigger companies. So Google's always interesting. How did you get through the Google interviews besides the fact that you had like your side hustle that was actually quite interesting? Did you feel like there was a specific answer you gave that was like their eyes or anything that you did?
At the time, you know, Google was a little bit less structured. So that's why I had like probably more interviews than, you know, now Google is extremely structured. So you only have four interviews, and they measure that after the fourth interview, you only have like diminishing returns in terms of extra information you get out of the candidate. So mine was a little bit of longer experience. And I think what really moved the needle though, for I think, is Google fundamentally is looking for an ability they call GCA internally. That stands for a general cognitive ability. Basically, are you smart? And they used to have famous questions like, how many golf balls fit into a bus? You know, that sort of thing. And you just need to be, I guess, able to take away those kind of questions and have like good mental mathematics and be able to take a step back from the problem they give you, kind of like test the assumptions and have like a logical pass at how you would tackle the problem. So I think those answers that I gave in that genre, that's what moved the needle.
Cool. I mean, how many golf balls do you fit in a bus? And I mean, do they tell you how big the bus is and what type it is? Or?
I mean, that's a fantastic start, right? First, you want to test the assumptions, right? You take a step, and what kind of boss are we talking about? Like a school boss, or kind of like a, you know, maybe something more substantially sized, like a National Express type of thing. Then you try to understand.
Yeah, it's like luggage spaces. It's just like a place where people are sitting.
Yeah, exactly. Are the seats taken out, or is everything in? Then you try to guesstimate the space that you have, and then how big a golf ball is, and try to estimate. Something. But they are not asking those type of questions anymore. It kind of puts people on the spot very much, and they do continue focusing on GCA quite a lot, but more in the context of the role that you're applying for. So they are asking questions relevant to what you will do on the job, so problems that you will encounter in your role.
What about you and your interview process? How do you interview for your team now?
Yeah, for the senior level roles, we actually have a task that's really central to the application process. So, of course, we do the usual stuff. The person applies, they answer a couple of questions online. We ask things like, what excites you about free trade? So we want to kind of filter in community members or people who would be community members or excited about free trade. I think that's a big part of it. Then we ask a more substantial question related to the role. So we see those answers online in the application system. And then a screening call, and then this task that I mentioned that is central. So it can be something like taking 1 or 2 hours to put together a quick presentation about how you think about the role or specific problems in the role. And then we actually do apply GCA as part of the interviewing process as well, like related questions as well as leadership and cultural fit questions.
Interesting. And then on the subject of interviews, could we go through the process of how you then came on board at Free Trade? Because you mentioned that it was because you were like a bigger investor compared to anything they'd had before, and that just led to some conversations. But then how did that lead on to you becoming part of the business?
Yeah, I wouldn't call myself a big investor, but I was definitely the first one.
Yeah, the first to be.
I'm glad to hear you consider my modest wealth big. But it's a great question. So, you know, we had these conversations with Adam. I actually met him in person. I just wanted to shake his hand, the person who is building this fantastic product for us. I was really impressed with how prepared he was, how much he knew about the brokerage industry. And eventually, we discussed that a growth marketing kind of role would make sense for Free Trade to build up the wait list. And then I told him that I'd like to throw my hat in the ring, so to say. And then I had to clear an interview with our CTO at the time, which was maybe not as structured, but quite in depth, a 2-hour interview. And after then, both he and Adam were happy enough to add me to the team. His questions were not so dissimilar to, let's say, what I would have had at Google. He definitely wanted to figure out if I'm smart enough to kind of like stand on my feet and be able to deal with tasks independently and build the wait list, grow a Free Trade's audience. So definitely there were cognitive ability type of questions, but also kind of like cultural. It's a very tricky environment when it's, let's say, the four of you kind of like early team, because there is so much at stake and it's so difficult to get started. So you need to have the right type of person who is able to execute independently at a high quality and be able to still collaborate really well with everyone else. You also want to have like a good initial trust toward this person, because everyone of that tiny team is kind of like the single owner of their domain, right? It's not like there's another marketing person or even another engineer at the time. So it's a mix of things. And I would say super early stage is not for everyone. It requires a specific kind of grit that you need to have. And you need to be able to kind of like get through the ups and downs and a little bit the isolation as well. For some time, we decided not to pay for an office for a couple of months because it just didn't make sense for the team. So we were working from home, all that stuff. But yeah, some people thrive in that environment. And I greatly enjoyed working with Adam in that environment. I thought his communication was really efficient.
Interesting. Thanks. Okay. So now that you've joined Free Trade, like what were sort of the differences of tasks that you've had over the 3 years? Because you joined as just like one of the first sort of four founders, I guess. And now you're like quite a big team. How many, like 50 people?
Yeah, almost 60 people at this point. Yeah, my role definitely changed.
And what was your first raise when you joined? It was like...
So 2017, that's when I joined. My role changed, obviously, quite a lot. But the nature of this change is that we took this from zero to 150,000 customers. So free trade has made a long journey, a lot of progress, and kind of like the things that I was doing would not necessarily scale at this level. We need more expertise and professionalism. I'm still hands-on. I still do individual contributor work all day, every day. But also there is a strategic aspect of my role, building our marketing strategy informed by data and based on the abilities and the unique strengths that we have. But also I have to work with my team every day to execute a good quality. We fundamentally cover and work with three different channels. One is organic, word of mouth. So we do a lot of things to power that through telling our story, PR, that sort of stuff. Then we have referrals, that's free shares, which you are familiar with, I'm sure. So it's another channel that we built and we are optimizing, and it's a really strong channel. And we've just started paid digital marketing, Facebook, and we plan to scale it up a little bit more as well. And for all these things, we need more full-time attention and kind of people who are more experienced. I'm personally not a paid Facebook expert. I'm privileged that I was able to hire someone who is really versed in that area. She was actually sitting not far from me in 2006 at Google. Then it was like the early times. Then she became a paid performance marketing expert, and I was able to hire her on to free trade. So yeah, thankfully our team performs a lot of the hands-on as well as strategic thinking, but I have to oversee that and try to take us to higher levels of delivery and more installs.
Yeah, loads of things.
What's the kind of things that have been most difficult? Have you had like breaking points of like you were doing things in one way and then sort of as you grew it became like too difficult and you had to like completely reassess how you did things and change the way you have meetings, this kind of stuff?
Definitely. It happens all the time, right? And you know, one example that comes to my mind has been a little bit hard for me securing PR coverage because I never worked in that industry. I never really had that background. I ran two of the kind of like highest traffic blogs in Hungary at one time. So I kind of had a concept of working with journalists and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But suddenly I was in an environment where, you know, securing coverage for a startup that has not had VC investment yet. It's a little bit of a different genre. It's possible. And I was able to make progress. But at certain points, I had to take a step back. It's like, what is the right approach here? Should I call journalists? What is exactly my story? What is our messaging? What is our narrative? How do we tell our story? Maybe there is a more efficient way to tell our story and how purpose-led and amazing we are. So I was able to refine at certain points and secure coverage in TechCrunch and other publications. But yeah, that was one channel that I had to take a step back sometimes. There are so many examples of this for everyone. So it's the normal way of operating.
Cool. What about like communication? What mistakes have you made in terms of communication? How have you like fixed those?
One inefficiency that we had was kind of like writing down what we are exactly about and communicating that. And it's kind of like, let's say Rolling Stones gets on the stage. Everyone wants to hear Satisfaction. It's always the same song. You always have to consistently have the same message, not be kind of like innovative on the spot. You need to understand your audience. And you need to be very conscious who you are talking to. And fundamentally, all our messages are very targeted towards our community. So it's very important to keep in mind that we have to tell the story of our progression and the vision and what we are building. And yeah, it just took some work. And I think it was successful, you know, in the sense of community building. Yeah, that's maybe one inefficiency. But I can't think of like a specific error or anything.
Yeah, like okay. What about like communication within the team between each other? Because that's always a source of like errors for people.
Yeah, that's always a work in progress, right? So every team kind of has their domain and their expertise, and they are very versed in that. And the biggest outcomes we get when we work together and we are able to collaborate to produce something that's greater than its parts. So we started implementing structures we call verticals. So for example, they have a growth vertical and there are marketers in there, engineers, a data person, a designer. So that's very helpful. But we just have to have a continuous process and structure to make sure that communication happens and we are actually aligned and we set kind of like unified goals and we are all working towards the same goals. if that makes sense. But yeah, that's definitely challenging and always a work in progress. It's always, even at big companies, that's not something that's always perfect. But I'd like to think that at Free Trade, we decided to go for this at a very early point, which was very beneficial for us.
Cool. Okay. So I guess now, like, finishing to talk about how you've had success with the different crowdfunding campaigns and like what's the future, where you're going. So each campaign, I guess, they've kind of got bigger and bigger. Have you always felt worried as to if it would work each time? Because you've kind of done a really good job every time, but has it always been like, oh, I wonder if anyone will invest? Or
yeah, to stay with the Rolling Stones, right? Is the next concert going to be bigger, more people interested, right? So, I mean, maybe not like worried, but there is always the notion that I don't think you should be presumptuous about anything. You always want to reinvent yourself, kind of like take the learnings, take the experience you made in previous campaigns and elevate that and figure out like how you exactly elevate that, how you take it, how you take what you did in 2019 and reinvent it for 2020. And we've had a lot of progress. So we went from, you know, the last crowdfunding round, we had 25,000 customers. We have 150,000 now. So just by the sheer progress, there's a good story to tell, amazing milestones and achievements. But still, in terms of how we do the campaign, it actually became more sophisticated. Obviously, there is more people. So the team is almost 60 now. And we are able to do, you know, higher quality visuals, higher quality imagery. But we are also able to tell the story in a more compelling way. We've built more journalist relationships. We've built more relationships across the industry. And we launched products. So it all comes together. And we kind of took a step back. We literally have a Google document. This is our communication campaign. Like every week we do kind of like this or that. So we kind of have that schedule locked down. But how we execute is more sophisticated. It's better, if that makes sense. But yeah, never be presumptuous with any of these things. But also don't be like stressed. Just take a step back, understand how you can make it even bigger. Because one thing is for sure, you cannot do the exact same thing you did a year ago or 2 years ago. The world has changed. The whole environment is different, right? But it's also an opportunity to tap into all these changes and elevate your campaign.
Yeah. So when you're preparing for a campaign, how do you make sure that it's going to launch well? Because that's a big failing of like most of the ones that fail is like they didn't have a good launch kind of thing. So how do you make that happen?
I think having a plan that's very detailed is a good starting point and collaborated on with the team from a very early point. So everyone is on the same page and everyone internalizes that this is what we as a team are going to do. And this is my specific role and specific tasks. And they care deeply about the success of that. So that's sort of a little bit over planning and even over communicating, I think, are really important, because in the end, you can have the greatest plan, but if the execution is not on the right level, then it's not going to be executed properly. So you're not going to have the same level of success. But yeah, I think going into overdrive with planning and internal communications is definitely the right starting point for a good campaign.
Okay. What about if you don't have a team of people and it's just you? How do you then like launch something?
There is advantage there to be a little bit contrary. You don't have the transaction cost of communicating with someone else, right? You are on your own, so you exactly know what you are thinking. I think it still makes sense to take good notes and kind of like take some thinking time, like take a step back and really think through how your campaign should work and look at how other companies, even in different industries, do these things and have a good plan for yourself. But at least you don't incur that transaction cost. So that counts for something. There is advantage there.
Sure. So, I mean, if there's an interview for Google, I don't think I'd pass you on that. On these answers, I feel like we've gone like for the top level of really plan with the team, but what's going to go in these plans? I mean, what's the actual stuff that I do?
Even before you start doing that, you want to understand what is your product, and most important, do you have product market fit? Do you have like evidence of that? And have you started showing your product, showing your idea to friends or random people in coffee shops once the lockdown is over? And you know, start building a concept of who this product is for and what it really solves, even to the level of how they describe it in their own language. So building a really strong concept of what your product is, that's where it starts. Then you can think about, you know, how you explain it, what your narrative is, what your messaging is. And you can, you know, literally jot down sentences or send out a survey to your followers or whoever you manage to sign up to your wait list or anything like that. And you will ask them what excites you about this product. So you kind of get a sense of how you can communicate your product to more people. So pick up these tangible bits and pieces and try to message it into some sort of a communications plan. If you want like a template, there are like plenty online. But I think it's as simple as like opening Google document or Word document or something like that. Just literally start writing, this is how I talk about my product. This is what it solves. This is why my company exists. And start messaging that into some sort of communications messaging. And then you're able to start thinking about like the specifics you need for the crowdfunding campaign. But first, it's about figuring out who you are and what your product is and why. Those very fundamental questions.
Okay. And then how to get hold of people? Is it like building email lists, and where do people come to get them into an email list? These kind of things.
So I'm assuming your product is direct to consumer or like a B2C type of thing. And you already have like an initial concept of who they are. And it can be as simplistic as you set up a Twitter account and you start following relevant people. You build an extremely simple website with Squarespace or WordPress or whatever. And you build like a very simplistic waitlist. Many companies did that. You could argue it's been overdone maybe to an extent, but it's still kind of like creating that initial pre-product audience first community, or literally audience, is to me one of the best ways to go about figuring out those questions, and which will later inform your go-to-market strategy as well.
Cool. And now that we've gone through all of these, I guess it makes sense to hear your pitch on free trade of what's your message for this crowdfunding raise?
Free Trade's mission is to get everyone investing. So as a company, we always have this deep insight that the way investing is going to be only more mainstream. If you consider what you do with your money, we don't foresee really like a super high return savings accounts coming back. And you know, also there are so many negative trends in the world, increasing inequality and millennial poverty. But the bad thing is that people are not caught into the growth of the world. People don't benefit from the growth that the world is experiencing. Virtually every product and service is created by companies. And, you know, amazing companies have been born. You know, Google is one of them, or think of Amazon or trillion-dollar companies, but like other companies as well, doesn't have to be tech. And some of them grow, innovate, become more efficient, but who benefits from that wealth creation, right? It would be only fair if more people would benefit from that. And basically, free trade is at the focal point of this fundamental change in the world, that more people will be partaking of this creation, of this growth. But at the same time, I can share my own personal experience around that. So when I figured out I wanted to invest in 2012 or 2014 or whenever, this was like way after the 2008 crash, right? And I was looking at stock charts and looking at ETFs, index trackers and all that. And I was like, man, it was so cheap at that point in time. In 2009, everything was so cheap. When is it going to happen again? Is it going to be 10 years? Is it going to be 15 years? And suddenly it happened. And I'm fundamentally an optimist. I think the world is going to become a better place over time. We will defeat this virus. We will get on top of it. And the world is going to open up again. And you'll be able to travel and consume and all that stuff. This is now, in my view, a historic opportunity to at least look at investing or learn, explore investing a little bit more. I should add capital at risk, of course. You should always consider what you want to invest in, but it's a great opportunity to get started. Things, you know, like stocks, ETFs, have not been cheaper for a long time. So that's the way we are looking at this crisis.
Yeah, it's interesting. Cool. Is there anything that you would be using at the moment in terms of the insurance? Is like, what have you been doing with your money? Kind of thing. Is it sort of, you going for like safer things right now, or are you kind of playing it like, ooh, very good opportunities?
I mainly invest in ETFs because they are diversified. So I invest in an S&P 500 ETF because I personally think the US economy is going to do better over a long enough timeline. That's my belief. I also invest in a dividend ETF because I like income. I like getting those dividend notifications myself. But I also have a small list of high quality companies that I personally consider high quality based on their fundamentals, based on their management. There are a couple of high quality companies in the UK as well as in the US in my mind. Basically, my suggestion is if you're a newbie investor, research a lot, read as much as possible, read books, podcasts. Mm-hmm. Also, you can come to our community forum and discuss your investment ideas or how to get started.
Cool. On the subject of stocks and shares, as you said, this is your sixth crowdfund raise and it's going to be quite big. Are you guys planning to IPO in the next sort of 4 years?
Well, we don't know yet. It's potentially one path that we might take. But yeah, it's too early to say.
Okay. Just wondering. I mean, what are the other things that are on your options? Just more crowdfunding or just sort of level off just grow naturally?
Even before this whole coronavirus situation, we've always had a business plan how we are going to make revenue. And that came into focus in 2020, even from the beginning of this year. It's been our focus to build that out. But now we actually feel it's even more important to start generating revenue in significant amounts and building that up and become a profitable company over time. That's the vision.
Cool. Okay. So it'd be nice to go a bit deeper into your specific marketing insights for a bit. So what would you say are your top three tips for marketing that you've learned?
I think people tend to separate communications and marketing quite a bit. I personally think, particularly from a startup perspective, your communications strategy is really essential and should inform your marketing. I'm a big fan of the organic channel. Sometimes it's easier to get started with, you know, just running paid ads with a limited budget and kind of get initial users and initial traction. That's legitimate as well. But try to work on your strategy. Try to work on your product market fit. That's really important as well, because if you are a product-focused company, if you're a tech company, obviously I'm biased, there are other types of companies, but having product market fit is so essential. So that would be probably my second tip. And maybe as a third one, in the context of scaling your team and building out your marketing, you can't know everything. Try to scale yourself, but you know, you are only one person. So over time, you need to hire people. And typically what I see with startups, they tend to hire kind of like quite junior people, which is also fine. They bring a lot to the table. It's also great, but if you're able to hire people with more experience that can really complement you, and if they have deep expertise in a broad domain that you really need, whether that's like the paid side of things or something specific to product growth or anything, that can really complement you. So don't be afraid of hiring more experienced people.
You think of like the value of what you're spending and like, oh, I can teach them to do stuff, but actually if someone's like a bit old and they've got like so many contacts, it's just they can open so many doors straight away.
Can be good ROI as well if they can attract other people along.
This knowledge. Okay. What would you say are your three biggest mistakes that you see people make with marketing?
Maybe the number one is spending a lot on paid channels, whether that's, you know, you are seeing all these companies tube advertising. I mean, when we are not in lockdown, so pre-lockdown. Very often I see that, and particularly when it comes to fintechs and startups, I think it's just like a lot more important to lock down your product market fit and get started with the organic side of things first. So I think overusing paid channels, coming to them really early is probably one of them. Then probably the second is not really working with product and not really working out your product market fit and not making sure that, in the context of a tech startup at least, not working with product and engineering enough to kind of like come together to the same direction that this is what the product is and this is who it is for. And then third, I think you can't collect and analyze data early enough. You know, even if you have nothing, you don't have a product, you can always set up a very simplistic website with Google Analytics that's free. You can send a survey to your 50 followers. You can start generating insights. And over time, you want to become professional at it. So you want to start thinking about your data platform and, you know, building that out and what kind of instrumentation are you going to use. Is it mixed panel or whatever? Thinking about your data has to start on day one. That's probably another, maybe the third mistake I would mention.
Interesting. So what would you say is your favorite brand?
It changes all the time. I really like looking at other companies and how they position themselves and all that stuff. Like recently, I really like Superhuman, how they nailed the organic side of things with thought leadership and positioning the CEO as kind of like a thought leader. He actually wrote a fantastic article about product market fit, creating an engine of product market fit that continuously makes his product Superhuman better. And I think he tweeted something like he spent like 4 days writing that article. but in terms of ROI, in terms of how many users that brought in for Superhuman, it was gigantic impact. So I do like how they position the product almost like a computer game in a way, or kind of like a gamified version of Gmail, like better speed and all that sort of stuff. I think they have it really down, and they actually do a concierge onboarding. You get to have a Zoom call with someone for 30 minutes.
Cool. Interesting. I'm going to look into that post. What's the best marketing campaign you've been a part of?
I would call our last year's crowdfunding the most successful. We thought about it deeply. We invested a lot of mind space and execution into it. It actually became too successful in a way. So as you mentioned that at the beginning when we were chatting, you are aware that when we actually went to CrowdCube, when we actually launched even the private part of the campaign, we actually obliterated CrowdCube entirely. And we just brought in too much traffic, too many people try to sign up and create accounts. And it was actually a little bit of too much of a success situation. We had to spend the rest of the day getting back to people, apologizing and trying to get it right for them, kind of like, you know, setting up a thread on our forum and explaining everything, doing an FAQ, that sort of stuff. So that's kind of like how our campaign ended up. It was a lot of fun, and eventually everyone forgave us. That was great. And CrowdCube has been working very hard to get their tech set up for bigger campaigns.
That's amazing. What do you think is the future of marketing? So in 5 years' time, what are people going to be talking about? It's like the new strategies.
I think a lot of the conversation is about like technology, AI, and all that sort of stuff. I'd actually go the opposite way. I think telling your story, kind of like connecting with people, is going to become even more important. Because if you consider like all the potential acquisition channels, right now it's a special situation because of the coronavirus. Facebook, Google, they are not as saturated as they normally are. But all the acquisition channels are saturated. If they are not, eventually companies are going to figure it out, and they are going to flood that channel. One channel that is very hard to flood is basically telling your story in a great, compelling way, writing a blog post that becomes viral. I mean, of course, it's easier said than done, but we were just discussing the example of Superhuman. We also recently penned an article about investing in infrastructure for the future. Near viral is really beneficial for our company. So organically telling your story, potentially utilizing PR in that process as well, that I think more and more companies are going to cop on to that science of
this. Yeah, people just don't want like boring companies that have personality. So sort of like...
Exactly, yeah.
It's going to be... free trade, you know, like you get a feeling of what it's like, whereas big banks and things, you kind of just don't really know them, and like, why would you use them if you have someone...
Yeah, exactly. And being a good company in general, transparency, fundamentally having a purpose, like these are things that are not so easy copy from a marketing perspective. Well, saying it is easy, of course. Oh, we are different. We are a good company. We are transparent and all that stuff. But actually delivering evidence day in and day out. And let's make no mistake, transparency comes at a cost. It's a two-sided blade. We announce features well in advance. We share our plans and all that stuff. Or if we miss the deadline, then there is definitely a backlash. But delivering that day in and day out is not something that's easy to copy or easy to saturate. So I believe from a marketing standpoint, these kind of like higher level ideas will help you differentiate as a company. And of course, the tech is going to become better. We'll see what happens with tracking and data and privacy and all that stuff. Some of the stuff is going to get more sophisticated, I should say, and better analytics tools and all that sort of stuff, which is great. But having a kind of like a higher level concept of how I do my marketing communications, I believe that's going to be more prevalent and kind of like more useful for marketers in 5 years' time.
Cool. Have you got any favorite quotes or like piece of advice that someone wise once gave you?
Lots of them. Yeah. But my recent favorite is Steve Jobs' quote, "You can please some people some of the time." So something we learned through scaling is that when we were pre-product, sort of everyone had a really great impression of what the product is going to be and all that. And the reality is always that you have to launch, you have limited resources, you have to prioritize certain features, and maybe some other features will not arrive on a short schedule. So as we've gotten to 150,000 customers, we are becoming more and more mainstream. So we have like certain, you know, types of feedback. we should implement this or that, but we kind of have to pick our battles and have to prioritize. So we can't please everyone, unfortunately. That's probably a wisdom that I would share.
Cool. We'd love to hear your opinions, and you're certainly very welcome to share the project to get yourself a free book credit.
Right, I'll check it out first. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I'll go check it out right now, and I'll ping you on WhatsApp.
Cool. Thanks so much. It's been my pleasure interviewing you, and great to catch up again.
Likewise. Yeah, it was great chatting. Always a pleasure.
Good luck with the campaign as well. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I did. My goal for this podcast is to help make people happier and wiser, and I'm also working on a few other projects in the podcasting space to achieve the same thing. I run the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast with a friend, where we read and discuss a great non-fiction book a week. We talk about things like philosophy, psychology, the economy, self-improvement, and business. Books such as The Black Swan, Anti-Fragile, Invisible Women, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's a great resource. I also run the Curious Comforts podcast, finding out what's going on in the world and how to improve it with industry insiders. We've been focusing on the effects of the coronavirus lately, but I also discuss broader things like climate change and AI. Most recently, I've been building an app, Syncify. It's really to level up your podcast experience. You can connect with your friends in the app and listen to the same things. So you can listen live in real time with each other, or create shared playlists and catch up at your own pace. You learn so much more by discussing ideas with friends. It's really silly to listen alone. You can also discover and share brilliant episodes with ease without having to try and recommend podcasts in different apps and just it all getting lost and confused. So it's also good for combating isolation and mental health. I personally find social media quite antisocial, and I just don't find it easy to reach out to friends to chat for no real reason. But I do love doing things with other people, and listening to the same content means that I can naturally talk about the same things, and it just gives me that friend time without going out of my way. So I really hope that it can help you, and I just would love you to try out the beta version and help us build this. And obviously, do invite your friends. It's all about friends. So you can find out more about Syncify app by going to syncifyapp.com. Thanks for listening.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.